I'm giving a talk on a subject I've actually been actively looking forward to talking about. I thought I'd give a talk on the Buddha's teachings on how to sustain relationships with other human beings. There are a lot of books out there with scary titles like If the Buddha Was Married or The Buddha's, or, you know, these really just awful books that take advantage of people's search for guides and insights on how to be in relationships. And everything the Buddha taught for free, and it was meant to be passed on for free. It was never meant to be put into mass market paperbacks and that you'd have to fork over money. And a lot of the times what I've seen in those books when I peruse them, to me, is horrifying, because I'm somebody who actually spends considerable time in my life actually reading not only the Pali Canon, the recorded works of the Buddha, but also the teachings as it's been passed down through monks, nuns, for thousands of years. By the way, the monks, the Order of the Monks, is the oldest existent organization on the planet. For 2,500 years, without internecine wars or battles or bloodshed, Buddhist monks have been living peacefully together. And so I thought I'd talk about how they achieved that and some of the Buddhist teachings, both in his lay teachings and also in his teachings to the monks, so that we could use the tools to be helpful in our own relationships, especially the important relationships in our lives, whether with the people we live with, our family members, our girlfriends, boyfriends, whatever, that we can actually use these tools. Now, one of the first things I'll have to say, there's this myth that's perpetuated by Hollywood and movies. And you've seen this myth. It's all the time, this idea that somewhere out there in the world, there's one or maybe a dozen, but probably just one person that you're waiting to find. And when you find that one person, it will all be effortless, and you won't have to put any effort to it. And all you have to do is find them and kiss them. And all and at that point, the movie of your life will end, because it'll all be a foregone conclusion that from that point on, that there will be no struggle, that there will be no difficulty, that everything will go easy. And that's full of shit. The Buddha knew very well that the human mind is a mind that is set up to survive at all costs. And the human mind is a mind that is filled with unlimited capacity to justify all of its actions, and B, to blame all of its unhappiness and the turmoil in its life on other people. I'll give you a funny example of this. I mean, there's tons of clinical data where they interview husbands and wives and see how skewed they observe them, and then see how skewed each partner's interpretation of little conversations are, how self-serving the mind carves up experience. But just an example, I can on one night watch a British detective show, I'm prone to those, where a police superintendent will be hunting down a serial killer. And because I'm watching the show through the eyes of the police superintendent, I'm like, oh, bad, bad serial killer. Good, 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 good superintendent. May he quickly catch that horrible monster out there. And then the next night I'll watch Dexter, which is a show through the eyes of a serial killer, and which I go, oh, good, good serial killer, bad, bad police that are trying to capture him. That's the way the human mind is. Whatever we're experiencing in our own lives, we, even if it's through the eyes of a protagonist in a film, we justify and view the world skewed through those eyes, through our own eyes. We justify everything as being happening to us, and we rarely see our role in anything. We only know that, oh, at work today it was awful. All those people were really stressed out. They were doing it to me. Because we review or feel that everything that we experience in life is happening to us. It's not just happening. It's happening to us. Because I'm experiencing it, therefore it must be about me. So this is the self-centered, self-justifying, skewed, subjective way that we experience all of reality. And on top of that, then, we blame the people that we're around for the turmoil that often erupts in our interpersonal relationships. Now, the Buddha knew very well that the human mind was, A, not set up naturally for happiness, that it was something that had to be cultivated. It's very capable of finding true happiness, but it doesn't come about naturally. The Buddha said the way to happiness is against the grain. It's not natural what the Buddha's spiritual path is. It's a practice that involves a lot of effort. The human mind is simply set up to survive. It's not set up to be happy. And it's definitely not set up to be at peace with other human beings. The human mind is, in fact, set up to be suspicious, judgmental, worried, monitoring, hypervigilant, fearful. So that's not to say that we're without hope. We can, in fact, find true working partnerships, but it involves effort. It doesn't simply involve finding Mr. Right or Mrs. Right, kissing them, and then the slow dissolve to the happiness of the rest of your life. What that slow dissolve conceals in the movie is years and years of effort, compromise, negotiation, calm listening to the other person's perspective, things that will go over. All the things I'm going to be talking about, the tools I'm talking about tonight, are directly from the 2,500-year-old wisdom of the text, and I think they offer some really profound insights. So, with that, I'm just going to launch into the first of seven tools. The first tool, the Buddha said when there are two people who are arguing, or two factions of or groups of people that are arguing, and both sides have done unskillful things. The Buddha came up with a practice which is called covering the grass, or covering with grass. And it's a practice that monks have been doing for thousands of years when there are squabbles in the monastery. And what it involves is both sides get together, and they, well, first, before they get together, each side talks with the wisest, most, the monk with the most time that they feel comfortable with, and then they go and they meet. And before they're allowed to apologize, before they're allowed to say, oh, I'm sorry, patch it up, and then go back and then start bickering again, or start saying, I can't believe I had to apologize to those schmucks, what they're actually taught to do is to take turns, and rather than explain what they've done, to simply state what their long-term intentions were. And after each side explains what the long-term intentions behind their actions were, each side is asked to repeat the other side's intentions so that each side understands what the goal of the other group or other person is. Now, there's a point to this. In this 2,500-year-old group of months, they've discovered that if you simply apologize without understanding the goals or the intentions of the person that you're apologizing to, if you don't understand that their intentions are wholesome, then you're simply apologizing simply because you think it's the right thing to do, or because you think that if you don't apologize, you'll be a bad person, Or you think that if you apologize, it will somehow just make all the unpleasantness go away. Those apologies are hollow. Because you're not understanding the true cause of what's behind the other person's actions. And the person that you're arguing with doesn't understand why you're doing the things that you're doing. So the moment you understand each other's motivations, at least you can then have this common ground where you understand why the other person is acting in the way they're acting. And then there's a foundation for a true apology, because you don't simply think that the other person is acting willy-nilly trying to make life difficult for you. You understand, wow, in fact, this other person thinks the only way my job will be secure, or our family will be secure, or our relationship will be secure, is if we do the following sets of actions. They're really motivated by trying to make things safe for us. So when you have that understanding, then you can go about stating what you've done that you regret and apologizing. But it's an apology based on a mutual understanding of each other's intentions. And that's the foundation that allows for reconciliation of groups that have had even hundreds of years of squabbles, have managed to patch things up, because over time they see truly that although they don't always agree with the actions of the other person, they see that the other person's actions were motivated by skillful goals, long-term goals that were worthwhile. So that's a foundation that's called mitigating disputes. And again, only genuine reconciliation can happen through understanding what other people's intentions are. Not simply apologizing, not simply saying, I'm just going to acknowledge my wrongs, but if you can see what the other person is coming from. Now, there are times in the Buddhist canon where during the admission of our intentions, one group's intentions will be seen to be so unskillful, so wrong, that the other group will realize it's pointless to even engage. And they won't bother to apologize. They'll say, you know what, we can't be in the same monastery together, because your long-term intentions are completely incompatible with ours. And there are times in relationships where when you find out what the other person's long-term intentions are, that they're incompatible with your own. And the reason there's been fighting is because you find out, well, one person wants to have kids and retire to the country, whereas one person wants to stay in the city and not have kids. And nobody's spoken about the long-term intentions. So it's really important to understand what the goals of the people we have relationships with, what their intentions or goals are. Now, the second skill is knowing how to deal with one's anger. There's this myth that when we're angry, the best thing we should do is go and express it to the person we're angry with. Actually, there's no place in the Buddha's 10,000 pages of discourse where I ever heard him say, hey, you know what a good idea is? When you're angry, blow it off on the person you're angry with. That really works. In fact, what he said is, first, detach from the story and feel the feelings. Ask yourself, what does it feel like to not be heard? What does it feel like to be with someone who doesn't see my needs or takes advantage of my good nature, or whatever. Just what does it feel like? But don't get caught in the story. Just allow the physical feelings to arise and pass. When you get to a place where you felt the underlying feelings, find somebody who's wise, not the person you're in a relationship with, somebody else. A wise person. A wise person is not a friend who will say, yes, 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 why? Yes, you should be infuriated. A wise person is someone who in the past has actually had the temerity and audacity to call you on your shit. To say, well, that's funny. Just 6 months ago you were telling me about how much you desperately wanted to be in a relationship, and now you've found out that it's hard. You know, they're willing to not go along and say, yes, that bastard. Of course, if there's a serious situation where there's abuse, and of course they'll help you get out of it, and they'll tell you that you're staying in something that's being harmful, but they'll also be willing to tell you when you're blowing things out of proportion. So working and getting some sense of perspective from another human being who's wise, a wise spiritual practitioner, and then once you've let go of the full physical steam, you've discussed it with the person, at that point you're ready to have a limited discussion where each person takes turn expressing what they're angry about. But it's not something where you simply feel angry and then go and go into full force battle with the other person. In fact, there are plenty of times where in the text, the Buddha and his monks recommend not going to the other person. A, because you still might be too angry. B, you might not have any perspective on your role. C, they might feel that the other person is simply not in a place where they're ready to hear. Or that they're in a place in their life where the discussion won't have any positive results. So it's important to have an outlet, to have somebody that you trust to discuss before. This is why all relationships are, in fact, not relationships of two people. They're relationships that are supported by a support network of wise friends. There aren't really long-term successful relationships that happen in complete isolation. That's another myth. So, number three, when there's shame, when you realize you've done something that's unskillful and you want to apologize, the Buddha, in his talk to his son Rahula, and in his practice Patisaraniya Kama, discusses the same exact tool, which is basically find first a wise spiritual practitioner, someone that you trust, someone who's given you good insight. Acknowledge what you're ashamed of, what you feel you've done wrong, and then see if they think it's a wise idea to acknowledge it to the other person. Now, there's a couple of reasons why they might say don't apologize. The first is that sometimes, even though we're desperate to get something off of our chest, like, I'm really sorry when I did, and I'm glad that I'm talking about it now, well, they might not actually be in a place where they're really wanting to hear all the shit that you've done to them. There actually is harm that can be done to the other human being. So before we simply get things off of our chest, especially when we really want to get something off of our chest, it means we're more likely to be dissatisfied with the reception we get. Because more often than not, when we really want something off of our chest, at that point, we really want the other person to say, oh, it's okay, you're a wonderful person, you're the best. And what actually happens when you do amends, and I've done my share over the years, is the other person goes, yeah, you were a shithead when you did that. And then you feel, well, that's very ungracious of you. So, in fact, you really didn't mean to apologize at all. You just wanted to get something off your chest and have them accept it on the exact way you wanted them to. So it's important to have somebody who's wise to talk with, to see when you're ready. And that's when it's not something that's motivated by, I just got to get this off my chest. I don't want to feel the same way anymore. I just want them to know that I feel. It's when there's a sense of, you've talked it through, you understand the roots of why you acted this way, you understand what motivated you, so that when you come to them and apologize, you can literally say not only what you're ashamed of, but can also explain why you're not going to act that way again in the future. That part is crucial. Most people don't really want to hear how sorry you are as much as they want to hear that you understand the discomfort it caused them, and B, that you're not going to do it anymore. And in order to not do it anymore, you have to understand why you did it, what you were trying to get, and what the alternatives are. So those are the Buddha's teachings on dealing with anger, dealing with shame, and dealing with interpersonal relationships where both sides have done wrong. Now, number four, the Buddha talked about not becoming over-entangled in other people's lives. What this means is we all have a tendency, especially with people we love or care about, to not only care about them, but to actively want to control what they do, to actually want them to do what we say they should do. We want people to be the people that we think they should be. We want them to behave in the way that we think people should behave. We have a lot invested in the people we love doing what we think is the right thing to do. And this is a form of becoming over-entangled. It's called upekkha, or balance. The Buddha said that we should only engage in anyone's life, and this includes people we're married with, children, our lifelong partners, our family. We only engage with them to the extent that if they don't do what we want, we are not completely torn apart. In other words, if you're so engaged with somebody else that when they do something, and I'm not talking about something that anybody would hate, like they go out and start spending all your money or, you know, sell all your shit, you're married to a junkie, whatever. We're not talking about that. We're talking about just people doing what they think is best. And we're so over-engaged and over-dependent on them behaving in the way we want all the time, to the point that when we're not even with them, we're thinking about them. That's one clue you're over-entangled. Or B, when you start meditating, you start thinking about them. When you start thinking about them when they're not even there, it means that you are over-involved. You're over-entangled. The Buddha wanted relationships to be very much the things that we are paying attention to that person when we're with them, but when they're not there and we're with somebody else, that we're bringing our attention to that other person that we're with, that we're focusing our intentions and our focus on what's in front of us, not lost in a daydream of, oh, I wonder if she's doing what I want her to be doing right now, or if she's doing something else, or if he's doing what I want him to, or whatever. But in fact, that we have enough limit or restraint on how we're focusing our mind that we're not constantly going back and determining the way that we think they should behave. That we can, in fact, as they say in the Al-Anon program, which is very much a Buddhist-compatible tool, detach with love. If somebody's really doing something that you find unskillful, rather than trying to change their action by force or by demand, instead you can pull back and say, well, I love you, but right now you clearly have to do something that I disagree with, and you have to learn to see whether it's going to bring you happiness or not. Getting so involved with somebody that we become torn apart if they have another drink, or they, you know, go back to a job that we think is killing them, or do something. Eventually, at first, before we actively take actions, the proper thing is to simply pull back after we've expressed what we believe is the right thing. We let go and we pull back. Now, sometimes this is extremely painful. And this is why, of course, in life there are going to be one or two relationships where we're going to find doing this detaching with love, with, you know, holding back, it's going to be almost impossible sometimes. Parents with children, you know, people who are with lifelong partners. In certain situations, it's going to be extremely difficult to pull back and just let the other person do things that we believe are completely wrong. This is why the Buddha said, at the very least, notice how many deep, over-involved relationships you have, because every time you're in a relationship that you're that over-entangled in somebody else's lives and your happiness is so enmeshed in their actions, your chances for suffering and stress go up enormously. So be mindful of how many times you're willingly going to enmesh your happiness or make it contingent upon the actions of somebody else. It's best to minimize it as much as possible. This is why monks, by the way, aren't allowed to marry. It's not specifically because of the whole sex issue. The Buddha wasn't a prude, and while he didn't allow, while monks are celibate, the real reason is because monks are people that at any moment in time have to be able to wake up and move across the globe to be at another monastery. Ajahn Amaro tells a story of waking up one day and being told that he's moving to England when he's in, I believe, Thailand, without any warning. And if you were married to somebody else, of course, you couldn't do that. So the idea with the monks is that they become really, really patient and really skillful with each other, but they don't enmesh their happiness or their inner peace. They don't make it dependent upon the actions of the other people in their world. They cultivate a refuge. It's interesting that in psychology there's this term boundaries. You've heard of boundaries? It's funny. Boundaries are a very fun term because almost everybody doesn't really know what it means. Boundaries are not walls or limits you erect to stop other people from doing things to you. Boundaries are limits you put on your own behaviors to stop you from becoming over-involved in other people's lives. But it's funny, people go into therapy all the time and their therapists say, well, we have to establish some boundaries so you won't become over-involved in that person, so you won't become over-enmeshed in the internecine warfare of your family, so you won't become over-involved in what's going on with this friend. And people come out and they think, wow, I've got to establish boundaries to stop that motherfucker from doing what they want to do. Boundaries are, again, the limits that you place on your own involvement in other people's lives so that you can maintain inner peace for yourself. Which brings us to the next core teaching that the Buddha always talks about, which is developing a strong inner peace in your life so that we're not constantly trying to get our happiness from other people. The more there's a spiritual practice in your life, people always say, yeah, you know, I love it coming to a place and meditating, but I find it difficult to motivate myself to practice and listen to a guided talk on the internet when I'm at home. I'll give you motivation. Here's your motivation. Unless you have inner peace, you're going to try to get your happiness from other people, and that's going to suck eggs because they're not going to want to do what you want them to do all the time. If you make your happiness contingent upon other people doing what you want, you're making your happiness contingent on something you have no control over. So if you want to have a source of constant peace and happiness in your life, you can get a lot of it from outside, but if you want to make sure to guarantee that there will always be some peace in your life, the only way you can guarantee that is by having a practice, a spiritual practice. It can be any form, Hindu, Tibetan, Zen. It can be prayer based on Gnosticism. You can follow Madonna into Kabbalah. Please do that. I don't care. Get a spiritual practice that comes from within, that's not contingent upon getting it from other people or from your job or from your career. Because Scientology. Because other people can go away. Jobs can be taken away. Money can disappear in an instant. Investments can vanish right before your very eyes. The things that we attach our happiness to in the world can disappear. But your inner happiness that you cultivate through meditation cannot be ripped away by anyone. So you can have a guaranteed refuge, a place to find happiness in your life, no matter how unskillful your girlfriend, boyfriend, wife, husband, child, boss, plant is. Now the next tool is, we have two more, I'm going to go through them quickly. Relinquishing attachment to views. The Buddha felt this was very important. There's nothing wrong with believing that there are actions that are wrong and there are actions that are right. In life, there are actions that are clearly unskillful. I'll give you an example. Killing, stealing, lying, cheating, having sex that's illicit, that causes harm. There's being excessively judgmental on certain people and not on others. There's judging yourself unduly harshly while forgiving all, you know, other people, or vice versa. There's all these actions that are inherently wrong. And then there are many, many actions that are inherently right. But we get ourselves into trouble whenever we think, I know the right way. If you believe there's a right way, only one right way, and you're the one who knows it, and that other people don't know it, you're barking up the wrong tree. Because there's many, many right ways to do everything in life. There is no single right way. Even in spiritual practice, there are 8 tools that the Buddha said that, and any one of which you could use at any time. So if somebody is practicing generosity while somebody else thinks, oh, that generosity practice, that's for beginners. I'm really up to compassion. Or I've moved on to compassion. Compassion's for 1 or 2. I've moved on to equanimity and concentration. Well, they're insane. That's not... The Buddha taught that there are many, many, many right ways, skillful tools, and there are many, many wrong ways. And if you get yourself into the position where you think that other people around you are doing it all wrong and you're doing it right, you're the one in possession of the right way, you're way, way, way off the course. There's a funny story that I saw about this ship that had a compass that was slightly, it was a computer compass that was slightly, minutely off. And over the course of an ocean voyage, they wound up thousands of miles in the wrong direction. But it was so slight in each moment that it was imperceptible. We follow thoughts like, I know the right way. I'm the one who knows. You follow that thought and you can wind up thousands and thousands of miles in the wrong direction. Now, again, what I'm not saying is some hippy-dippy, non-dualistic, oh, everything's right, everything's wrong, let's just live all together happily. There are wrong actions. There are right actions. But clinging on to our view of what's right actions as if nobody else knows other right actions, that causes all kinds of wars, battles, hatred, the Balkans. That's what's behind so much of nationalism and patriotism and hatred, the belief that one group is right and the other group must be wrong. So the Buddha even said that part of right views is letting go of right views, realizing when it's not time to share your views or to hold your views in front of other people. The Buddha, under no circumstances, would ever kill, would ever cheat, steal, lie. But he, on the other hand, when he was with people who would do those things, sometimes he wouldn't, in their face, tell them what schmucks they were and hold his goodness in their face. Sometimes he realized that people were just trying the best they can and were on the path to discovering true right actions, but it wasn't useful for him to hold up his beliefs in front of them, so he wouldn't bring it up. That's what's meant by not over-attaching. You're still not going to cheat, lie, steal, or kill, but you're holding onto it loosely enough that you don't have to fight with everybody who disagrees. There are so many people in my life, as a long-term Buddhist, who've tried to pick fights with me about Buddhism. I've had literally on funny occasions, I've had Mormons come up to me in the park. And they're desperate to engage in. And part of the most wonderful thing is frustrating them by just going, oh, that sounds great. And like, oh, so you're going to join? No, I'm not going to join you. It sounds great, whatever. You know, it's wonderful. You found peace. Good. Go be happy. They're like, but, you know, aren't you going to fight? No, I'm not going to fight. It's useless. You believe what you believe. I believe it's totally useless for me to engage in a debate with you about Buddhism and Mormonism. We're going to get nowhere. I'm happy. You're happy. It's great. So that's the. I totally disbelieve and disagree with proselytizing in any form whatsoever. And I openly encourage you to stay with whatever spiritual path you entered into this room with. I don't encourage anyone ever, ever to change their religions because somebody tells them that their spiritual path is better. Follow your experience. And if somebody tries to berate or trick or logic you or fight you into following them, get as far away from them as you possibly can. So the final technique is having a foundation in the precepts of having a foundation in things that you absolutely will not do. The five precepts are, again, refusing to kill, to steal, to engage in unskillful speech, to become intoxicated and cause harm, and to cause harm through sex. If you have a set of spiritual foundations in terms of acts you will not do, no matter what, then you're less needing to get approval from other people. Because you know that you have something that no amount of money, no amount of coercion, you have virtue. Nothing can take that away from you. You don't need to get approval from other people all the time. You don't need other people to agree with you or see how wonderful you are, because you're already following a set of spiritual principles in your life that are inviolate. And if you have that, you're not going to be needing other people to agree with everything you do. You'll find a sense of esteem from your own actions. And the more you top it off with compassion and generosity, the more esteem you build, and you won't need approval from the people around you. If they don't give it to you, it won't matter, because you'll know that you're somebody who doesn't cause harm. If you wouldn't kill somebody even if I offered you $1 million, you have something that's worth $1 million. You have virtue that's worth $1 million. If you won't steal or lie even if I give you $1 million, you have even more things worth $1 million. You have true esteem and virtue. And if you have those, you will be less needing to control or get things from the people around you, and you'll be less likely to act unskillfully with the people you love. Because if you don't, under any circumstances, lie or steal or engage unskillfully in the rest of your life, you won't feel the pressure to do that in the relationships that matter most. So, very much, the foundation of a successful relationship is founded upon acting skillfully in all of our relationships. If you are willing to lie just to get around uncomfortable situations in work, you will be more tempted to lie to the person who's most important to you in your life. But if nothing can make you lie, or speak unskillfully, or cause harm, then you'll never be tempted, even in the most important relationship you're in. So those are the seven tools of being in long-term skillful relationships with other human beings from the original teachings of the Buddha. I hope that you found something of interest in tonight's talk, and if you have any questions, now would be the time to ask it, and thank you for listening.
I actually had to scour
large sections of the Vinaya, which is the large book for the monks, to find the teaching of the covering of the grass, and another sutta I found the the teaching about how to deal with shame, and in a third one, how to deal with anger. So it's really, there's no single spot